kind of special house with the kind of special room with the kind of special atmosphere. With the clickety old clock, go and take a tick-a-tock. Shh, Susan slept here. Oh, I can't describe the house and I can't describe the room, but the atmosphere is warm and dear. With the friendly whippoorwill singing on her windowsill. Shh, Susan slept here. Sunlight kisses her shoulder. That's one light I'm jealous of. Mirror, 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 jealous cause you're nearer, jealous cause you hold my love. I'm an ordinary guy with extraordinary luck, cause it's Susan who's in my career. And I'm tacking up a sign on the ticker of mine. Susan, Susan, Susan slept here.
Welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I am your host, Rob Kelly, and this week we are talking about the 1954 romantic comedy, I guess you call it, romantic comedy, Susan Slept Here, starring Dick Powell and Debbie Reynolds. And joining me to talk about it is from Book Steve's Library, Stephen Thompson. Steve, thank you for doing the show.
Not a problem.
Many of you are probably wondering, what is this movie? I've never heard of this movie, and I had never heard of it either up until a couple of weeks ago.
Really?
It
actually was expected to be pretty big when they were making it. I mean, it got a ton of coverage in the news, but I guess it wasn't really the type of movie that was popular at that time. So when it came out, it was a hit because supposedly it actually enabled Howard Hughes to go ahead and sell RKO at a higher price than he was expecting to get. But at the same time, it kind of faded away.
Yeah, I mean, the only reason I have heard of it is because it is part of the Warner Archive Collection. And on a previous episode, I mentioned that the fine folks at Warner Archive were kind enough to start sending the show some screeners of their releases too, so I could talk about them. And this is one of the first films that they sent. And so I watched it with very little expectation because, you know, it's funny. I mean, I know enough to know that just because a film doesn't get a giant release doesn't mean it's bad. It's just one of those films that just doesn't have a big marketing push behind it. And so I watched it kind of like, well, let me see what this is. But I actually really enjoyed this movie. It's a really light and frothy little comedy. It's the kind of thing that I think TV, once TV became big, kind of got rid of, is this kind of movie. It's a small little story. As I mentioned, it stars Dick Powell in his final film with Debbie Reynolds. And it's... the story is basically Dick Powell's a struggling Hollywood scriptwriter who on Christmas Eve ends up having to give shelter to a juvenile delinquent played by Debbie Reynolds. Apparently her mother has taken off and it's over Christmas Eve and the cops don't want to stick this poor girl in jail over the Christmas holiday. And because Dick Powell is writing a movie about juvenile delinquents, the cops, of course, make the total logical conclusion, hey, this young girl can come stay with you. And hijinks, of course, ensue.
So, it's almost, if you think about it, it's almost a pre-code kind of thing. It wasn't really the type of thing that they were doing in the early 1950s because it's got a little bit of naughty references and everything in it that you normally couldn't get away with during that period.
Yeah, apparently the Legion of Decency or whatever the group of tight asses that were involved in the 50s, like they really were kind of against this movie because it dared to suppose that a young woman who was not married would be sleeping in a house that was not of her husband's, like as shocking as that might be. And most people, of course, know Debbie Reynolds later on as, you know, the unsinkable Molly Brown or as probably more likely Carrie Fisher's mom. But you don't think of her in this sort of kind of like wild child strumpet role. But she's pretty good. She's funny. Yep. She's kind of more like a tomboy. But this film is directed by Frank Tashlin, the highly stylish director, Frank Tashlin, who directed The Girl Can't Help It and will success spoil Rock Hunter. And, you know, for a movie that is a fairly, you know, benign little cute story, there's a lot of really great visual flourishes here. And they have to be all due to Frank Tashlin, who had a distinct visual style.
Too. He had a great sense of color. He always did very well with color.
Yeah, this film is really nice to look at. I mean, it's really, really gorgeous. And again, he's giving it a lot more visual style than you would think a movie of this type probably would have gotten.
Well, he used to be a cartoonist, you know.
That's right. That's right.
So, I mean, he developed, I guess, that visual style because he had to. That was the job. And then when he went into films, he just took it with him. Because if you look at a lot of his films, you get that cartoony feel to it.
Yeah, yeah. And he later went on to direct even some Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck-like movies, like the feature-length movies.
Yeah.
Some of the other cast members in this movie, Anne Francis plays Dick Powell's character. Dick Powell's character is Mark Christopher. She plays Mark Christopher's sort of stuck-up fiance. She's sort of like a real princess. Glenda Farrell is really, really funny as Mark's secretary typist.
Glenda Farrell had played with Dick Powell in Gold Diggers of 1937, years before, too.
Wow. Okay. All right. that's an obscure one. Alvie Moore plays Mark's best pal and sort of his gopher.
He's great.
That was back when in Hollywood you could kind of look like Alvie Moore, who was this little pipsqueak guy, and say, I'm going to Hollywood. You know, we had that kind of a reedy, thin voice, and he was never going to be a leading man, but he's a great supporting player.
He literally replaced David Wayne, who was meant to be in that role originally. And the funny part is he had replaced David Wayne on Broadway, too, in Mr. Roberts. So he was always, like, following in David Wayne's footsteps.
He's always cleaning up after he's getting the crumbs.
They're sort of David Wayne light.
Yeah, yeah. And in terms of a comic book connection, it's a tangential one, but Mark's lawyer is played by a guy named Harvey Butterworth, which is a great name for a lawyer. He's played by Les Tremaine. And for a lot of us of a certain age, we remember Les Tremaine as Mentor on the Shazam TV show.
Yep. And us old radio fans remember him as Mr. First Nighter.
Who is that? I have no idea.
It was a show called Mr. First Nighter, and he would introduce like Broadway play type things on the radio and said, well, here we are again. I'm Mr. First Nighter, and I'm here to – and that was Les Tremaine as well.
Ah, okay. He had a great voice, so that's no surprise that he did radio. No surprise at all. This film is unique in that it is opened by narration coming from an Oscar.
Yeah.
It's an anthropomorphic Oscar that is narrating the story because Mark is an Oscar-winning screenwriter. It's funny. Dick Powell is playing 35 here, but he ain't 35.
Well, he doesn't say he's 35. He says she makes reference to him being 35 or something. He said, yeah.
Just a slight pause. Sure, I'm 35. where did you first see this movie, Stephen? I mean, I really thought when I first got it from Warner Archive, I'm like, how am I going to find anybody that's seen this movie?
In my case, my mother always told me that her favorite actor was Dick Powell when I was growing up, and the local TV stations never had any Dick Powell packages. There was nothing that I could watch him in except Abbott and Costello in the Navy. That was the only thing I'd ever seen him in.
I forgot he's in that. That's right.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, one day when I was about 16, 17 years old, in an afternoon movie, I was home from school or home from work or whatever, all of a sudden they ran this movie. And I thought, hey, that's a Dick Powell movie. I'll try that. I had no idea at the time it was his last movie, but I gave it a shot. I knew Debbie Reynolds, of course. And I thought, wow, this is just a great movie.
Interesting.
Loved it.
Yeah, it's really a lot of fun. There's a wonderful dream sequence that Debbie Reynolds' character Susan, of course, of the Susan Slept Here, has, and that's such a Frank Cashlin touch. I mean, it's such a because it's there's like she's in a cage and she's doing all these twirls, and Mark Christopher is in this really sort of weird outfit. I mean, it's very, very surreal, and it's the kind of thing that I think they purposely stuck in movies at the time to compete with television. They were trying to give you something that you couldn't see on TV.
In the early part of the picture, you can see a photograph of him in a sailor outfit in his apartment, and I guess she sees that picture because then he's got the, like, spangly sailor outfit in her dream sequence.
Right, exactly.
And, of course, he was known for playing sailors in a lot of his old movies, too, when he was his first part of his career. I mean, let's face it, Dick Powell had the best second act of anybody in Hollywood. I mean, he started out, he was the pretty boy crooner, you know, and with the high-pitched voice and everything and light comedy. And then all of a sudden, he reinvents himself as the toughest, tough guy in Hollywood.
Yeah. And it's interesting that this ended up being – I mean, it's credited, of course, as his last film, and it is. But it's not like his career ended at this point.
Oh, no.
I mean, he went into – he did a lot of TV after this, and he did a lot of directing.
He had actually more or less left the big screen prior to this even, and they had to coax him back into it after all of the problems getting the film cast. I mean, originally it was supposed to be Dan Daly opposite – Debbie Reynolds, and Dan Daly, and David Wayne as the sidekick. David Wayne got held up because he was on another picture, and then by the time that ended, he was injured, I think, and then by the time he finally recovered, he had to go into a Broadway play, so he wasn't able to do it. That pushed it back even further, and so Dan Daly eventually had to leave because he was committed to a Fox musical. At that point, they cast Robert Mitchum. And Robert Mitchum and Mickey Rooney were going to play the Dick Powell and Al Borders.
I'm trying to picture Robert Mitchum and Mickey Rooney in a movie together, period.
Well, Mitchum apparently had no intention of actually doing it. He was cast in it, and he allowed himself to be cast in it just so he could walk out and make a statement about how he felt they were mistreating him. And Howard Hughes was not at all happy and said, "You'll never work in Hollywood again," which, of course, never happened. But then they tried to coax Cary Grant into doing it, and Grant turned it down, and so they basically begged Dick Powell to come back and do one last picture. But I don't know what happened to Mickey Rooney. I never did find out what happened to him, but by that point they replaced him with Albie Moore, which again makes more sense following David Wayne anyway, since that seemed to be what his career path was.
Yeah,
but he's great, especially in the dream sequence. I thought Albie Moore was hilarious.
Yeah, it's like it's a really like light, cute, and sort of frothy little movie that I think it's about 94 minutes or a little bit more than that. And it just moves at a nice clip, and people are very witty. I mean, it's got a great screenplay. There's a great – Glenda Farrell has a great line about where – I forget who – she's talking to her boss, Mark Christopher, and he's talking about how he won – Oscars, and he's like, my last hit was that Jane Russell movie, and that made a ton of money. And she says, "You're not the writing; the screenplay was not the reason that movie was a hit."
Yes.
Like, okay, yeah, I get that.
There are a lot of great lines and a lot of great deliveries of great lines throughout the whole movie too. Debbie Reynolds is impressive as all get out, except for the fact that I have trouble recognizing her as a 17-year-old when, at the time, this was a couple years after Singing in the Rain, where she was playing older than her age. So now here we are looking at her younger than her 22 years, and it was just a little tricky looking at it in context.
They put her in kind of like big kid clothes. Like the first time you see her, she's in like tomboy jeans, and they're too big for her. I mean, I mentioned earlier about Frank Tashlin's visual style. When she first comes into the movie, and she's brought in by these two cops. And by the way, I should mention, one of the cops is played by a great character actor, Herb Vigran.
Yep.
And I know him because he is from White Christmas. He plays the owner of the restaurant. Bar that Danny and Phil not Dan yeah I'm blanking on Phil and Bob find the sisters at. He's running the place, so he's one of the cops. And when they first bring in Debbie Reynolds, like, she runs around the set, the camera follows her around in an almost 360 shot, and she like zooms into the frame, and she gets picked up in the air, and her fists are flying. Like, it's a really kind of wonderfully composed and interesting to look at sequence, again, for a movie that's sort of modest like this. It's Frank Tashlin was really putting a lot of effort into the visuals.
Oh, yeah. And again, it wasn't expected to be modest. It was expected to be a huge hit. They were really trying for something to pull RKO up after they hadn't been doing so well. And a ton of coverage in the newspapers. I found maybe 50 articles about it before the film ever even got made. But at the same time, and apparently it was based on a play that the guy who wrote and produced and co-wrote the movie was the guy who had co-written the original play as well, Alex Gottlieb. But I haven't been able to find out who starred in the original play. Someone told me that the sidekick role was originally written for Mickey Rooney, which might be why they got him at one point for the film, but that fell through.
Okay.
So he may have played it on stage, I don't know.
Interesting. I was going through my notes, and I just found here that, and I'd forgotten this just a second ago, that this film was originally made to be in 3D, which...
I had forgotten that. Yes, you're right.
That's weird. And second of all, now that shot makes sense of Debbie Reynolds as she runs into the frame. You're like, that would have been kind of a really cool 3D shot.
And the fantasy sequence, too. That would be great.
Yeah. In terms of the romance between these two, because eventually, of course, as you might imagine, Susan and Mark Christopher fall in love, like... Do you buy that? Do you really feel that that really works, or is it just the movie forces them together because it has to?
I don't buy that. part of the reason for that is that as an adult male, I have long had young female friends who are younger than me, and you really don't have that kind of feeling for them. You know, it's I don't know. It's complicated perhaps to describe it, but it's not, "Oh, I think I'm going to fall for you just because you're running around here and acting silly." You know. Especially when he was gone for, what, 3-4 months, and then he comes back and he's deeply, madly in love with her? No, I don't think so.
Yeah, they end up going to Vegas at one point. That's and he does that. He does it to sort of make an honest woman out of her. They get married there.
Because, and see, they could have really done without the age thing. I mean, she didn't have to be a juvenile. She could have played 22 years old, whatever, and it would not have that slightly pervy feel that it has, which is impossible to avoid otherwise because of the constant reference to how young she is.
Well, that's true. But I mean, I guess if she was an adult, she wouldn't be forced to stay there.
But they still could have arrested her for something, and they sent her there, you know, and I don't know. Might have worked.
Yeah. It's interesting how, again, these old movies have views of cops, because it's like it wouldn't be too much longer until cops became, in some films, definitely a target of suspicion and derision, if not outright cynicism about their, you know, corrupt nature. But here, cops are just sort of like good fatherly figures, and they're looking out for people's, you know, best interests and their welfare, and they're kind of like – they're like priests almost, and they're just, oh, we found this waif on the street, and we don't want to put her in jail over Christmas, so here, go live with a really rich screenwriter. That'll be a nice thing.
Yeah, at first, Horace McMahon, the other cop, I thought he was going to be the bad cop to Herb's good cop, but it turns out they're both good cops. I like that.
Yeah.
Somebody else that is in the picture is Mara Lane, who, from what I understand, was known as the Marilyn Monroe of Great Britain. Now, this was obviously before Diana Doris, who we all think of now as the Marilyn Monroe of Great Britain. But I found a couple of articles where she said this was the only American film she was going to make because she doesn't like the American film industry.
Interesting.
And as far as I know, this is the only film, American film, she made.
I guess the feeling was mutual between Hollywood and Marilyn. Yeah,
Marilyn. Zsa Zsa was trying to get that role as well.
Oh, I could see that. Marilyn is gorgeous, though. I mean, she plays the neighbor that Virgil keeps seeing, and he ends up following her around like one of those characters when they smell something delicious and they float in the air and stuff like that. She looks like like a Dave Stevens drawing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, she was walking around in these super high heels, and, you know, it's like, again, this is this world of Hollywood where everybody lives in these sumptuous apartments, and everyone is gorgeous, and everyone has, you know, like, probably millions of dollars for their wardrobe. I mean, it just has that kind of look to it.
Well, you also have almost every role, little tiny roles in the film even, are people that you know. I mean, Ellen Corby is in there. He's not even credited on IMDb, but Benny Rubin is in there. His character has a name. His character has lines. Benny Rubin was on the Jack Benny Show and had his own short subject comedy things for decades back in the 30s and 40s. And yet he doesn't even get listed on IMDb, but he's in there. And IMDb actually has Dawes Butler and June Foray even as voices.
Really?
I didn't hear them, but it's
there. Yeah, wow. I missed that. If they're in there, I didn't hear them.
Yeah, and Ken Carpenter is the Oscar at the beginning. Ken Carpenter, a very familiar voice to us old radio fans. So, yeah. And then, of course, the surprise cameo at the end.
Yeah, right. Yeah, Fred Skelton shows up. As the, and he has no lines. Like, he just sits there. Yeah. I have to figure he did that as a favor for Frank Tashlin, maybe. That seems
come to think of it, that's very similar to the role that Groucho played in what was that film with
Success Spoiled Rock Hunter?
Yeah, that was that a Tashlin film?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, so very similar.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Interesting. Yeah, it said Frank Tashlin again is one of those really interesting guys. And about 15 years ago, there was a movie called Down by Love with Ewan McGregor and Renee Zellweger, which was sort of
I always get those two mixed up too.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't a parody, but it was sort of a gloss on those kind of Frank Tashlin, Doris Day movies of just wild colors and everything looks really beautiful. I mean, he said this was really something that I think as TV was encroaching on Hollywood's, you know, turf, they were like, we got to give people something that they can't see. So, this film, even though it takes place mostly in, you know, just one set, this apartment, it's a beautiful looking set. I mean, it's, again, the vistas are really beautiful. The dream sequence is really interesting. The colors are sumptuous. It just has that, you know, you're not going to be able to see this on a tiny little screen in black and white. So we're going to give you something really interesting.
Yeah.
And as you said, this thing was a hit. This thing was a really big hit.
Mm-hmm. And literally, I think it's the chemistry between the characters ultimately that worked. So I think they ended up with the right casting that they needed because Powell has that kind of world-weary thing that I really don't think Dan Daly could have pulled off. He was kind of lightweight with these kind of things. And Mitchum could definitely pull off the world-weary, but could he have pulled off anything else that needed to be in the character.
I'm trying to picture Robert Mitchum in this part and romancing 17-year-old Debbie Reynolds. That would have been really creepy.
And Debbie is perfect because she does start out as a juvenile delinquent, and she decides she's going to better herself. And little by little, we see her doing it, and it's hilarious. But at the same time, she's making real progress. Everything, I think, works as far as the chemistry between the two, even though there's long sections where the two of them aren't together in the film. And Glinda Farrell, I think, is just marvelous.
Yeah, Glinda Farrell is very funny. That feels like if you couldn't get Thelma Ritter, you would maybe get Mary Wicks. And if you couldn't get Mary Wicks, you could get Glinda Farrell. I don't mean that as a slight to Glinda Farrell, but it's like she just seemed like the less famous version of the funny housekeeper, the funny assistant, the funny something, and who you just give a couple of great lines to, and she'll just knock them out of the park. And she's very funny in this movie.
And Anne Francis is hilarious too. I mean, you don't think of her necessarily as being a comedian, but all of her scenes, especially on the phone with Debbie, are really funny.
Yeah, that's it. It's a really cute little movie, and it's the kind of thing that, you know, I know that I'm being a shill here, but that's okay. I'm going to live with that. That Warner Archive does is that they get these sort of obscure titles that you really would never hear of and be like, here, we're going to put them out for you. And, you know, it's on a nice Blu-ray and it looks really beautiful. So it's a really fun little movie. And it's the kind of thing where, again, you don't see them anymore. They really don't make movies kind of like this. And it's a delightful little piece of entertainment.
They do. You just never get to see them because they go straight to DVD now.
Yeah, that's probably true. So, do we have anything else we want to say about Susan Slept Here?
I think I'm good. That covers everything.
All right, very good. Well said. This is a really neat little movie. You can get it via Warner Archive. There will be a link in the show notes to it. So, Stephen, again, thank you for doing the show. I appreciate it. Where can people find you on the internet?
People can find me on the internet at Book Steve's Library. Just hit Google, it'll pop up. I don't remember the exact address. I have 11 other blogs at any given time, so feel free, just type in Book Steve and they'll all pop up.
Very good. And if any of you enjoy some of my articles for Back Issue, you can have Steven to thank because he's done a lot of the transcriptions for them, and I think he's probably taken out all of my broken English and mistakes and ums and errs. So I appreciate the effort you put in to make thank me look you. Good. All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening. Again, you can get this title via Warner Archive. Check out the links. And Stephen, thanks for doing the show. Thanks, everybody, for listening. You can find the show on Twitter. It's Film and Water Pod. And you can leave a comment at the contact page over at our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. So thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.
This stinks. The more I type, the more I wonder if he could ever write.
Now, Miss Maud, you know Mr. Markin, right? Didn't he just write a hit for Jane Russell?
His story is not what made that picture a hit.